Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things we can do for people and the planet. My name is Kevin Folta. I'm your podcast host. And today we're going to tackle an important issue that has really brought up a lot of questions recently for me and for many other people. It's about the question of meta-analyses. Now, on the podcast, I like to really connect you with science that is new and exciting. But how do we know that science is really new and or exciting? In other words, how do we critically evaluate a piece of work and really go through it to understand if the claims being made are as significant as the authors may suggest? So this is what I do every day as a scientist, and it's difficult sometimes, even for scientists, to be able to hammer through what some of these papers mean, especially when they go through more higher-end statistical machinations, as we see in the area of genomics or epidemiology. But now we have an issue that even clouds the topic more, and that is the concept of meta-analysis. So meta-analysis, well, we'll talk about what that is with our guest. So we're speaking today with Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He's a senior epidemiologist who has served on the faculty at the Albert Einstein School of Medicine at Stony Brook University, but really has been best recognized as an epidemiologist, practicing epidemiologist, who interprets literature for the public, both in books and in talks. I actually met him when he gave a talk on the evidence of connections of cell phones and cancer and other physical problems. So welcome back to the podcast, Jeffrey.
Great to be here, Kevin.
I really appreciate you making the time to do this, because I know that meta-analysis, just from your reading your recent work, has been of a major concern. And last year we spoke of the meta-analysis, which seemed to have some rather significant massaging to get the outcome that they did. And so I really wanted to tackle this because this audience is a science-savvy audience, but, you know, to be honest, I even get blown away by these meta-analyses, and I have a hard time evaluating, are they legit? And, you know, and what's, you know, and can I really take something home from this? And when I'm having trouble with this after years of training in statistics, you know, I am a little bit concerned. And so I really hope you can help us drill down on this today. So first, let's start out with, what is a meta-analysis?
A meta-analysis is simply a process of combining a number of relatively small studies and to evaluate them as one large study. So it's trying to integrate the results of a number of studies. And the reason for that, which we'll get into more, but the reason for that is supposedly the more data you have, the larger number of patients, subjects in this combined analysis, the more reliable your results should be. So that's the basic idea.
Well, is this part of the reason why there's so much confusion around different topics like, you know, diet or, you know, meat consumption or, you know, alcohol use? Or how much of this plays into major contemporary questions in society through meta-analysis?
Well, the hope would be that meta-analysis would help us to clarify these persisting problems, like what is the relationship between alcohol and breast cancer, which we epidemiologists have been studying for 35 years at least, actually since the inception of meta-analysis. And the problem in a nutshell is that observational studies, epidemiologic studies, in contrast to randomized controlled clinical trials, are subject to a number of biases and problems. So you always have to take that into account in evaluating these studies. And we were asking people about how much they drink, and you can get, you're not getting the kind of hard, reliable data you'd like. Then, when you combine these studies, you mash them together into one super data set and you analyze the data, your meta-analysis, the results, are only going to be as good as the data that went into it. So that's the basic problem we're dealing with. But then there are other issues that we'll get into.
Well, one of the big issues for me is it seems like there are more and more of these coming out all the time. And, you know, what do you think is the basis for that?
Well, in fact, there's been an absolutely dramatic increase in the number of meta-analyses. In 1990, there were all of 272 published meta-analyses, and this number has increased dramatically, actually geometrically, over the past three decades. And in 2019, there were 22,000 published meta-analyses. That's an 80-fold increase.
What do you think is the reason there are so many more meta-analyses than there used to be?
Well, meta-analysis is considered to be at the apex of different types of data that are different types of studies. It's above randomized clinical trials. So I would say that putting meta-analyses at the apex of the pyramid of different types of studies is aspirational. There's the hope that the use of this technique could resolve these issues that we spoke about, such as alcohol and breast cancer. But in the real world, and we'll get into this, in the real world, there are many reasons why this aspirational savior, that could resolve some of these vexing and longstanding questions that we would like to know the answers to, there are reasons why it falls short.
Well, I think one of the reasons, just my hypothesis, is that these are relatively, and I don't mean this in a bad way, but relatively easy to do, in that you don't need to go capture the primary data. You don't need to do the original experiment or the clinical trials. That these more painstaking, time-consuming, and resource-consuming endeavors are already complete, and now you're taking the outcomes of those and healing several together into one cohesive work. So it's not like you have to start from square one. You're really assembling everything that's there. And in the days of publish and perish and, you know, trying to get more work out there, is there just an incentive for faculty to engage in at least a meta-analysis in their area of expertise, because it's something that is doable and may provide some interesting direction?
You've really hit on a major factor. They can be done at low cost, just pulling the numbers out of the relevant stack of papers, and they get quite prestigious billing. In other words, they get published in high impact journals and they get cited a lot. So it really is, it adds punch to your researchers' publications. And for that reason, it's attractive. That's one reason why we're seeing this enormous increase.
A good example for me is in the glyphosate area, just for what it's worth. If you have a really good study, like the agricultural worker study of 54,000 agricultural workers that did not show an association with a given treatment, you know, really good study over many years, you know, prospective, all that good stuff over years, and it didn't show an association, why is it necessary to take on a meta-analysis to that then gives completely contrary data to that really excellent study. How necessary is it to take it that one more level?
You know something? You're asking the question that would be the first question that I would ask. And in other words, if you step back and you look at the lay of the land, you look at the different studies, and in the meta-analysis that you're referring to from exactly a year ago, from a number of researchers, there were five studies. There were a total of six studies that they included. One was the agricultural health study that you just referred to, which I call a Cadillac study in this type of work. And the others were case control studies where the data were of a much poorer quality. So the first question is, what benefit are you getting from mashing these studies together? And if they had asked that question, they would have avoided making a number of errors. Because one of the key things is that, as I said before, the results of a meta-analysis are only as good as the data that go into it. Well, a cardinal rule is that the data, the studies that are being combined, should be of more or less the same quality. Otherwise, you're comparing apples to oranges, and you're going to be seeing now the case control studies just had a number of things which signaled that their estimates of glyphosate related to this type of cancer were really not very credible, and they were not impressive. They were not robust results. So in combining, I don't want to overdo it, but you really suggested the point that people do this in a mechanical way, and they do it to increase the numbers, but in the rush to do that, they may be introducing severe biases so that you'll get a result of the meta-analysis, which they got, namely a 41% increase in risk of this rare cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, for people with any exposure to glyphosate. You're getting a result which may make headlines, and this did, but just looking at it in a common sense way tells you maybe this wasn't a good analysis to undertake in the first place. That doesn't stop people, unfortunately. And we see numerous examples. You've got to believe with these huge numbers of meta-analyses where you get things that are titillating and seem to offer you something, but if you looked at it critically, you'd really draw back and say, wait a minute.
Well, I don't want to drill too much on this one study. If people are really interested in Dr. Cabot's analysis, go back to episode 174 of this series where we discussed this in detail. But just to kind of synthesize your point on this, like you say that you have the Cadillac of studies, and then you compare it with four Kias of studies. You go a Cadillac and four Kias, and your analysis says cars cost $18,000. It doesn't tell you that the best one, or in this case, you know, is not $18,000. So it kind of takes away from the strongest value of the best quality instrument when you combine it with these lower quality instruments that don't have the same statistical weight and the same power that the really good study did. So, just to kind of resynthesize all of that for the listener, because I know this is a really complicated mess of an area. So, you know, with that in mind, how valid are most meta-analyses?
One assessment by a very well-regarded researcher at Stanford, who's a tremendous powerhouse, and he specializes in research on research, that is looking at how good are the studies that we're basing medical care or regulation of toxic chemicals, how good are the studies, and how do we separate the really serious studies, the really solid studies from the chaff, a lot of which is cranked out in the world of publisher perish. And this meta-analyst, John Ioannidis of Stanford, arrived at the conclusion after reviewing a huge amount of data, is that most meta-analyses are unnecessary, misleading, and conflicted. And he went on to estimate that perhaps only about 3% are decent and necessary. So that's a very severe judgment, but it's backed up. This technique offers the researcher a lot of opportunity to influence the outcome of the analysis. And what do I mean by that? Well, the whole analysis depends on which studies you include. And different people, different researchers, will have different ideas about which are the relevant studies or which are the highest quality studies, and that will influence their results. So we have this phenomenon of dueling meta-analyses, and that means that different researchers conducting a meta-analysis on the same question will come up with totally opposite results. And examples of this is the question of violent video games and violent behavior or mass shootings. Are they related? Does playing violent video games, does that lead someone to be more violent in the real world? And this is one example. This has been going on for 20 or 30 years. And there are different camps, and they fight, and they publish, and they say, no, your defense of your meta-analysis doesn't stand up. And so this is an example of the problem. And similar things could be said about questions like the effectiveness of antidepressants, where you're in the area of clinical medicine. Well, because there are vested interests, there's a huge, huge stake in the effectiveness of antidepressants. You have schools that are at odds with each other. And so there are problems with the data, and then there are conflicts of interest among researchers that can influence what they consider a good study and what result they think is most credible.
All right, let's say you have dueling meta-analyses where you have one which is supportive of a given concept, another one which absolutely refutes it. That usually only one of them makes it to the media, and it's the one that is the most inflammatory and sensational, and the one which has the most impact on changing the way people think about, you know, a topic. We all know food and diet ones. You know, the glyphosate one is the best example for me because it was ended up being used in a court of law in a major decision, and all other ones pretty much out the window. So, how does someone who's in the general public begin to understand or question, you know, what is real and what isn't when it comes to a meta-analysis?
That's a fantastic point. Your first point that certain types of results get the attention and others are totally ignored, because if you find, hey, in fact, the best studies do not show any signal that Roundup glyphosate is a cause of cancer, then people, that doesn't get traction. What gets traction is You know, if you've sprayed Roundup in your garden, my God, you're more likely to get cancer. And look at these poor guys who are in litigants, who are bringing cases in California at the moment. But there are, I don't know, there are more than 30,000 cases around the issue of Roundup. One tends to say, well, something must have caused it, and they must have evidence that it's glyphosate. This is a huge, huge problem, especially where there's huge amounts of money in tort cases and vested interests, and a huge, huge problem. So how is your second question, how is the average person to decide is really tough, especially since the media very often goes along. I don't want to blame the media for as the cause of the problem, but journalists don't have time the way we scientists do to dig in and spend hours and hours sifting through the data and saying, well, this is really not very impressive on the one hand, and here's what the good studies have to say. So I would say that there are outfits like Talking Biotech podcast, like the Genetic Literacy Project, like the National Cancer Institute, and others like the American Council on Science and Health, that by and large are very, very good arbiters of what is the quality and what is the consistency of the science on these questions.
Those are some good hints. I know that another confounding factor frequently are university communications offices who, because their report comes out that has a certain leaning, they too aren't immune from the bias, and their big interest is in promoting the university and the work that comes from its faculty, and may tend to even over-exaggerate beyond what the researchers once said. And that's what goes out in the press release and ultimately ends up changing the way it's reported by the media. And I've seen a few cases of that over the years, and it seems like it's only getting worse. So let's step off there. We're speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Cabot, previously on the faculty of the Albert Einstein School of Medicine and Stony Brook University. He's a senior epidemiologist who spends a lot of time connecting with the public about critical issues in epidemiology and interpretation of claims. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast. We'll be back in just a minute.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech Podcast. This week at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, you can join Dr. Folta in online lessons for children, first through sixth grade. He'll cover topics like viruses, DNA, where did cows come from, what are pesticides, and many other exciting topics. That's over on Folta's professional Facebook page at facebook.com/KM Folta. Again, every day except weekends at 11 a.m. You also can hear him discuss the news of the week with Cameron English over on the Genetic Literacy Project Science, Facts, and Fallacies podcast. They cover the hot stories, the breaking news, and break down the information and add their enlightening and sometimes interesting commentary. All of the expanded dedication to public communication is made possible because of your support on Patreon. Thanks for helping there, and thanks for sharing the stories of science with others.
And now we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast. We're speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Cabot. He's a senior epidemiologist who we're speaking about meta-analyses, what they are, why they're problematic, and maybe some ways we can improve them. One of the trends that we've seen over the last 20 years is that a lot of them are coming out of China. And so what can you tell us about those meta-analyses and that particular trend?
Actually, more than a third of meta-analyses are from China, and this picked up in the early 2000s and has accelerated. And there's a strong impetus for China to become a major power in biomedical research. Chinese scientists have very, very strong incentives to publish in English and to publish papers that are going to have an impact. This has been a big contributor to the what's been referred to as an epidemic in publishing of the epidemic growth of the publication of meta-analyses.
And you're right. I mean, I've heard so much about scientists who are actually, there's just a financial incentive that if you publish in a high impact journal or it gets a lot of citation, that individual scientists are rewarded with non-trivial amounts of money. And so that could be maybe kind of part of this too, because you're seeing these just this huge surge in this. But financial conflicts of interest aren't just in maybe, you know, direct finances like that to a professor to publish. You know, where do we see other potential conflicts of interest perhaps maybe influencing meta-analysis?
Well, I referred to the whole issue of antidepressants and their effectiveness and suicide associated with antidepressant use. And there, as you can imagine, industry has very strong interest. Industry is behind a lot of meta-analyses or researchers who get money from pharmaceutical companies. And so that's a glaring researchers who have consulted in the past, that's a glaring example of conflict of interest. But there are other subtler ones. Let's say it's exposure to cell phones and brain cancer. There is a tendency, because scientists are human, to want to bear out your hypothesis that there's something there. In other words, when people spend 10 years of their life researching a question, they can have a stake in there being something there. So if you conduct a meta-analysis, unless you are absolutely, you divorce your judgment about the quality of the studies from your personal inclination to your gut feeling that there must be something there, that kind of phenomenon is present in, and this, you mentioned diet and cancer. In diet and cancer, we have these violently opposed camps, like the low-carb, high-fat camp versus the low-fat, high-carb camp. And so there are lots of, if you read in that area, there's lots of dueling points of view and lots of deep belief that in spite of the limitations of dietary studies, which are a fact of life, people want to believe that they're on the track to getting at the truth. And so there are meta-analyses in that area. And so I think you see how these things can be colored, they can be influenced by scientists, by their investment in a question.
Yeah, and I'll bring up a point in how this can happen in a second, but you know, the one thing that's a little troubling when I listen to you talk about this is that this is what people always say about us. About like you and me, yeah. Us, you yeah. know, they'll say, well, he has a vested interest in seeing how this comes out. He certainly, and what's so funny about that And, you know, just an important point to make is that when you train in science and you're well-trained in science, that to me, when I test a hypothesis and the data come out contrary to what I originally hypothesized, that's a great answer. And what it's told me over the years is that I just underthought the process and that underthought the question. And that when I go back and do more experiments, that the real answer is much more interesting than I could have originally thought. And so to me, I'm very happy with data that refute the hypothesis or do not support the hypothesis, because they usually give me good direction in a better line of research. And I kind of made a career of that. Making a mistake on my first guess only to find out it was something much better. But when you're talking about these meta-analyses, especially when there are interests on the line, one of the things that I frequently see when I look at them is you look at the methods and they say, how did we decide which data went into the meta-analysis? Which papers did we consider? And you see statements like, we eliminated anything with a sample size smaller than this, or eliminated anything that had an outcome that said this. So there's rather arbitrary points of what to include and what not to include, that you could see how a bias in this would very easily select for inclusion or elimination of work, primary research going into the meta-analysis that would automatically skew the outcome. And how prevalent do you think that is?
I think it's very prevalent. It can be subtle. And remember, here's another point. Meta-analysis is mostly used, if not exclusively used, when we're dealing with subtle effects, when we're dealing with weakish risk factors. You don't need to conduct a meta-analysis of all the studies on smoking to show that smoking is strongly associated with lung cancer. There, you're dealing with associations that, depending on how what type of smoker a person is, a smoker of a pack a day, of two packs a day, of three packs a day, you get risks that are tenfold, 20-fold, 30-fold, and higher, okay? And you don't need meta-analysis to tell you that smoking is associated with lung cancer, because the effect is so strong and it's seen in so many different studies in different places. So when you're dealing with these subtle or weak associations, that's precisely where the studies are weaker, and they have less ability to really isolate or pin down the effect that you're looking at, such as alcohol and breast cancer, or glyphosate and cancer, or cell phones and cancer. And so by conducting a meta-analysis, what are you doing? You're using sort of iffy, weakish studies, and you're going to pull in studies where people have found something. Okay, like there's a really good example is the studies of cell phone use. And there's one group in Sweden that, whether they're looking at pesticides or whether they're looking at cell phones or whether they're looking at other chemicals, they tend to come up with risks that are sort of impressive, like threefold relative risks. And that group in Sweden has been judged to be sort of an outlier. Their data just are not compatible with all of the other studies done all over the world on these questions. And so if you conduct a meta-analysis and you include those studies, what are you going to do? You're going to get a result that's pulled up by those outlier studies. Commentators have said, you know, you can get any result that you want to get from a meta-analysis.
When is meta-analysis most applicable and legitimate and gives us really good information?
I think there are two two situations in which it can be useful if used judiciously. One is for researchers. If you look at studies and you look at the whole topography, you look at the whole terrain, all the different studies, and then you ask yourself, well, which are the best ones? You can then identify the highest quality studies, and you can see how consistent they are, or is there any way to explain why you see differences if they're all good studies and done in the same way? Presumably, they would show the same thing. So you can interrogate the data to learn something about how good a job you're doing. It's exactly what you were talking about earlier about your training as a scientist. That's one use. So if done in a even-handed way, critical way, you can learn something from conducting a meta-analysis. But that's for researchers. There are meta-analyses that could be of interest to the general public. And I'll give just one example. This researcher, whom I referred to out at Stanford, has done many different analyses in all, on depression, on psychoanalysis, on contaminants in the environment, on all sorts of issues, on diet, collaborating with all sorts of different specialists who want to collaborate with him to do a superior job of interrogating the data, of looking at what the data have to tell us. And one of the studies that he published looked at this. We all hear about physical activity is good for you. And there's been a long-standing question, well, does physical activity protect against breast cancer, for example? There's some evidence that it does. Does it protect against other cancers? So this researcher did a global meta-analysis looking at all of the studies in millions of people, looking at all of the studies that examined the effects of physical activity on any cancer. And what they came up with was that for most cancers, one can't really make the statement that physical activity is protective. But there were two cancers, and they happened to be two of the most common cancers. There were two cancers for which there did appear to be a protective effect. And those were breast cancer and colorectal cancer, two incredibly prominent cancers in the modern world, in the U.S. and elsewhere. So that's an example of, I think that's worthwhile, that's useful information for the public to know. That here, we know that being physically active is good for the heart, we know that it's good for the bones, and now we know that there's a decent bet that physical activity may be protective to some degree against two major cancers.
Well, see, that's the perfect example of how this could be used appropriately. And is there any, I know that Ioannidis has made some suggestions about how these things can get better going forward. So can you tell us a little bit about how can the scientific community, as editors and reviewers and as, referees of this kind of work, how can we raise the bar so that this kind of information is more helpful?
Okay. Well, first of all, Ioannidis's major idea is that we should improve the quality of research. And as in my reading on meta-analysis, I come back to, meta-analysis can only be as good as the studies that make it up. What Ioannidis comes down to is saying that forget about these moot these flashing meta-analyses and these studies that we have in the past. He said, in the future, the ideal is not going to be achieved, but it's important to hold out an ideal. The ideal would be for researchers with an interest in a question, alcohol and breast cancer, whatever, to communicate together and to set up criteria for the different groups could conduct their studies, but they need to communicate and they need to agree on what is an adequate measurement. How do you measure alcohol intake? What population should you use? How do you do the best studies you can do? And if you do that prospectively, you start from scratch and say, we're going to crack this issue by doing superior, by doing higher quality studies. Then, once you've conducted those studies, they could be combined in a meta-analysis, and the researchers from different camps with different points of view would communicate, they would analyze the data, they would argue, and you would come up with a much superior, a greatly superior product, because it would have the benefit of this give and take, and everyone would have a stake in a high quality meta-analysis. Now, there are so many incentives that work against that, namely time and money. So we're going to continue to see the kinds of meta-analyses, some of reasonable quality, but probably a small minority, and most of them things that need to be taken with many grains of salt. But you mentioned editors and reviewers need to be more critical of what gets published. And let me tell you, a colleague of mine wrote to the editors of the journal that published the 2019 meta-analysis, the poor meta-analysis, and wrote and pointed out some of the problems, and never got an answer from the journal. So this is symptomatic of something, and it's not a lone story. People dig in their heels. People are really protective of their results. And but ideally, we'll focus on the people who are trying to improve the quality of research. And maybe that's always going to be a minority, but hopefully that will carry more weight. And let me add, I know I'm saying a lot about, let me add that in January, the US EPA reanalyzed in a very thoughtful, carefully done meta-analysis of the six studies that I referred to, the Cadillac study and the five Kia studies. And lo and behold, what they came up with was that there was no 41% increase. There was a 14% increase, which was not statistically significant. In other words, they came out and said there is no, we stand by our earlier determination with this more detailed meta-analysis that there's no association between glyphosate and cancer.
Well, that's really good advice, the idea of how we could make these things be better instruments and more successful. But we're in an age of predatory publishing, and how much of low-quality predatory research gets into meta-analyses to cloud those results, and then how many meta-analyses are published in those low-quality journals?
I haven't actually looked at that. That's a very good question. Look, I think that definitely some papers that may qualify that are published in predatory journals or so-called pay-for-play journals are getting into the data sets that are being used. And it wouldn't surprise me that that these journals are publishing their own meta-analyses, because with these numbers of papers coming out, they've got to be published somewhere. So it is a problem.
Yeah, it's a really important point. And so if you had to give some advice to the average consumer of science, like just, you know, someone who maybe is just a science enthusiast or even just an average consumer, what advice would you give in terms of how much weight they put into a meta-analysis?
Okay. Well, it depends on the topic, and it depends on it's hard to generalize, because in some fields we know much more than in other fields. So one has to be wary of the lone study that comes along, or even the lone meta-analysis that comes along. And again, I would suggest that one go to websites or books or publications that devote their time, that put in a lot of effort to come up with a critical assessment of what is worth paying attention to. How well does this stand up? So I mentioned some of those websites before, because there are so many questions out there. There's so many issues dancing around that we'd like to know the answer to. And on many of them, it's probably not worth worrying about them. But where there is some solid information, you will get that from the National Cancer Institute, the Genetic Literacy Project, and so on. Because these people feel an obligation to provide an interpretation of what's important, and to be critical about the latest news stories, like the American Council on Science and Health does. They're indefatigable in looking at the latest news stories every day and making sense of them, or really debunking them where there's nothing to back it up.
Well, that's really good advice. So really the best advice might be then for people interested in these kinds of topics to identify who you trust for that information, and then pay attention to their synthesis when it comes to how much weight we put in a meta-analysis. So maybe in a nutshell. But if people wanted to learn more about you and what you do, or maybe follow you for good information on these topics, how would they do that?
Okay. Well, my website is simply jeffreycabot.com. So Jeffrey, spelled the English way, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, and last name K-A-B-A-T, as all one word, so jeffreycabot.com. And that has all of my articles and the latest articles featured, and interviews and so forth. I'm also on Twitter at Geo Cabot, all one word, at Twitter. And there's an Amazon page for my books. And that is, if you type in Amazon.com and Jeffrey Cabot, it'll come up. It's also under books on my website, so that's easy to find. And I might mention that they're putting out a paperback edition of my latest book, Getting Risk Right, which has gotten some very, very nice reviews, which are also on the website. And so the paperback edition is just coming out this week. So that's very nice. Maybe it'll rekindle interest in the book. So well, that's basically it.
I have some ideas for your next book. Could you do one called Meta? Do a retrospective analysis of the claims that were made in meta-analyses, because so many of these things have resolved and have played out either with the addition of new data or the addition of time. And so for instance, the analyses that said connections between brain cancer and cell phones, if that was true, I don't think you'd have a person walking around who would not have brain cancer. So I do think it's maybe, you know, worth some time to go back and reevaluate those. But so what do you think?
It's a good idea. I think it's a good idea. And I'm always working on trying to come up with an idea that I really think has the right saliency, and that is something I would want to do, and not be too hard on the reader in terms, and hard on me in terms of the amount of data that it's conveying.
Yeah, well, if you need a co-author on that one, let me know, because it's a neat idea, and I think would have a lot of traction, because for these days when we get sucked into inflammatory claims and news sensationalism, and we forget about the claims that were made even last week, let alone 20 years ago.
That's a great point, because why is that? Because the news is forward-looking, and because scientists, well, if your work didn't pan out on brain cancer, there's always something new and exciting, or cell phones, there's always something new to latch on to, and one just moves on. And, you know, you sculpt your new grant proposal to try to get attention and get funding. And so nobody tends to look back. And I've made that point, and that's what I did in my two books. Look back and say, how well did we do with these issues that got so much attention and so much money from the government?
Yeah, the dumpster of time is filled with tinfoil hats. Well, thank you very much for joining me. And you know, thank you, listeners, again, for all of your support, whether it's through social media and sharing these episodes, telling friends, or even your support on Patreon. It's allowed us to have a full-time producer and really start to push this concept of talking biotech through more channels. And look forward to increasing our listenership and more people to share these discussions. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next week.
The Talking Biotech Podcast presents the personal views of Dr. Kevin Folta and its guests. These are not the views of the University of Florida, its faculty, staff, or students. Comment on today's episode on the Talking Biotech Facebook page. Send comments and suggestions to kevinfolta@gmail.com. And remember, tell a friend, write a review, or float us a little love over on the Patreons. Your support will directly translate into this podcast and broadening science education efforts everywhere.